Welcome back to He's Abroad. This is Jason here in Brooklyn, joined once again by John, who's abroad, sort of, in Vancouver, Canada. I got to figure out this introduction.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think you need to. I'm abroad, but you can just say it abroad in Canada or abroad in Vancouver.
All right, fair enough. I don't understand. I didn't realize abroad.
There's a border. That's all, abroad that's just all means that... across the border. That's it.
All right, fair enough. That's smooth sailing from here on out. This is the last time I'm going to fuck that up. All right. Easy. Well, here we are. We're going to talk about Oppenheimer.
Yeah, so we're doing another review of
movie. Speaking of borders, let's talk about the time we dropped some bombs over borders. Yeah.
So if you didn't listen to the Aquaman 2 review, we used to do this quite a bit, and we're going to try to get back to it. We're going to try to review movies on their own. If you listen to our regular podcast, that means just maybe not as long doing some of the entertainment stuff. We're going to try to split it off a little bit so we can spend more time. So anyways, finally watch Oppenheimer. It's fitting as we're recording this on the day of the Oscars. Oppenheimer is a favorite in quite a few categories to win some Oscars, to win some Academy Awards. So you saw this movie a while ago.
Yeah,
this
I movie saw it came in theaters.
Out- Yeah, okay. So this movie came out a long time ago. I'm interested in your thoughts from a theater's perspective of what you remember. So real quick, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, you'd be kind of dumb not to. Oppenheimer is the story of Robert J. Oppenheimer, right? That's the dude's name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Oppenheimer Smith.
Yeah. About the story of basically the building of the atomic bomb during World War II and the aftermath of the building of the atomic bomb. Of sort of what happened afterwards to the community that was part of that scientific endeavor to end World War II. This is a Christopher Nolan film. So it comes with, you know, IMAX visuals, sound, all the things of, you know, the filmmaking experience is super important to Christopher Nolan. This movie, interestingly enough, also came out the same time that Barbie did. There was a lot of marketing around these two movies paired together. I personally think that probably helped this movie. Is this whole Barbenheimer thing, this very different look of World War II, death and destruction, and Barbie, and those two things being paired together at the same time of, you know, a big push from Hollywood as a whole to go out and see the movies, go out and watch Barbie, and then watch Oppenheimer, or watch Oppenheimer, and then watch Barbie for a palate cleanser. It was a lot of that marketing that was going on at the time. So this movie did very well in the movie theater. Obviously, it's been critically acclaimed. I would say the reviews are quite mixed from people who watched it. Really? I'm interested.
I think so.
I can explain maybe why. I'm interested in your what you remember from the theater experience of this, because I watched this at home. I don't necessarily have some crazy sound system. I have a big enough screen,
I don't know,
but yeah,
I don't know if I buy into your mix from the audience perspective. It's got an 8.4 on IMDb, and that is good. Like that's
the mix is there though. From people that I've talked to, there's different mix of whether or not you like this movie. And again, it's compared to Barbie in a lot of ways. Just from a, like, ignore that they're two totally different stories. They couldn't be any further from each other. But there's enough similarities to like the filmmaking aspect. Like I'm just gonna come out and say it. The sound of this movie is horrific, in my opinion. It's one like it's Christopher Nolan's gotta quit this with trying to explain to me that watching it a film, I need to watch it in his perfect conditions, because the sound mixing was just bad. It was poor, and it was poor in Tenet, and it was poor in Dunkirk. He's got some real issues with how he mixes sound, in my opinion. So there's one thing. Again, I haven't given you my opinion on this movie, but the sound in this is horrible. It's bad. And so I'm interested to hear, when you went to go watch this in the cinematic experience that it's supposed to be, was that any better? Because it was terrible in this movie.
I had no problems with the audio in this movie. And
you understood everything everyone was saying?
Uh-huh.
All of it?
Yeah, I saw it in IMAX.
Yeah, okay. So you saw it the way God intended it to be seen.
Yeah, God being Christopher Nolan.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I had no problems with the audio mixing. I agree. He has weird ways of approaching audio, starting with that, you know, the Dark Knight Rises intro teaser that he did before Mission Impossible. And you literally could not understand what Bane was saying the whole time. And they did. I don't know if he was forced to mix that, you know, to remix it, but you listen to it now and it comes through clear as day. I assure you, watching that in IMAX, you didn't have any idea what Tom Hardy was saying.
No clue.
The whole time.
None.
So... Now, granted, it's fine because the Hans Zimmer score was so good in that movie. But anyway,
to be fair, the score in this movie is good. It's not bad. Oh, yeah. It's just, to me, it's sort of like the pretension. And again, I think this hurts some audiences with his films, it's like the pretentiousness of filmmaking. Again, he is a purist in the like, as far as filmmakers today, he's probably one of the most purist as far as a modern filmmaker, right? You can go to Martin Scorsese, who always has something to say about a superhero movie. But for the most part, he is a purist. He cares about film. He cares about the cinema. He cares about all the technology going forward with IMAX and Atmos surround sound. And again, he is making movies for that experience. And Oppenheimer, this is one of those movies that I remember seeing the trailer for going like, this isn't, like, I get it for Interstellar. I get it for Inception. I get it for the Batman movies. Why do I need to watch a historical fiction? And I get it for Dunkirk, right? It's a war movie, right? It's a movie about war, big visuals. Why the heck do I need to watch this for Oppenheimer? I didn't feel that pull just because I know enough about the history and the story of this. But that's why I'm asking, because I would say the visuals in this movie, I get why this is an IMAX film. I understand why it's this cinematic experience to go see. I can see that connection. But I found specifically the sound to be really grating. And it's really hard to understand what people are saying if you don't understand the story of what this is. Because there's like two people talking, and the score starts to ramp up. And I go, why is this being scored as if this is some pivotal moment? And they're like, okay, let's see where this goes. And it's just a basic conversation. It's just two people talking. And I'm like, right. Okay, I don't think I needed that there. Like, what are you trying to achieve here? He just does a lot with sound in this film. And so that's why I'm asking of how this was, where, you know, you've not seen it again, I'm assuming. I'm assuming you've only seen this once.
No, I wanted to see it again, and I will eventually, but... Because, all right, let's first talk about the sound thing, and then I'll answer that question. The sound that I thought it was fine. Yes, it does create these moments of grandeur with this score when people are just talking. But the whole movie is just people talking until something explodes. Right. And then that's when the sound hits at its best. So he did a really good job of playing with that. Like, that whole sequence when they do set off the bomb eventually
I've got thoughts on that as well. Like,
it's that the sound for,
again, and maybe this is just my bias, because look, we know this is who Christopher Nolan is, right? I'm the whole hype of when this movie
and you like this movie.
I enjoyed this movie, but the sound and specifically that explosion, for a guy that has spent so much time talking about how useless visual effects are and it takes away from filmmaking, and I'm gonna build my own bomb to prove how this is. What an underwhelming, impotent moment that you built up for an hour and 45 minutes to show me the power of this destruction. And it just looked like a regular TNT explosion to me. I didn't feel any sort of gravity of, oh God, what have we done? It was just like, here's an explosion that I got to set up. See, you can do visual effects with an explosion. You know, you can do visual effects without using computers. You can just go out into the desert and build an explosion. Why can't you all be like me? And that's just, it's soaked in his films now that he's like got a point to prove. And I find it really annoying. It bothers
this, me. This is where the movie, though, I think earned its IMAX standing, because, you know, a movie like this that's largely people talking, you think, why am I going to see this in IMAX? Like, this movie came out about 2 weeks apart from Mission Impossible. That's a movie you want to see in IMAX because of the huge set pieces and that kind of stuff. But this leveraged, I will defend it, because this is where it did take advantage of sound, because you're not going to capture this. Yes. Unless you have a Dolby Atmos system at home, you're not going to capture what this is tuned for. Just like video is tuned to the computer that it was created on, and it's created for certain situations, it's going to look different depending on what you watch it on. And, you know, you get some people watching it in like that, you know, that porno vision with the, you know, like motion smoothing on and that kind of stuff. And you're like, oh my God, how do you watch it like that? I'm sure very similarly, you could watch it on your TV speakers, or maybe you have a sound bar or something. And it's like, oh, how do you just watch it like that? How do you just listen to it like that? Because, yeah, visually it was underwhelming. As a bomb goes, right? But as a full experience, it's amazing when you're in a theater.
Like, and again,
it's him being a purist of
the medium of movie theater film, right? Mm-hmm. And that this is where, like, I get it, right? This is where I go, this is, again, I really like this movie still. Like, I'm nitpicking here on the things that I didn't like, that I think again, a lot of people watch this and they go, well, why do I have to watch this the way you want me to watch it? And there's points of me that goes, well, he's the filmmaker. Like, yeah, you should see it. You know, if someone tells you to eat at a restaurant versus eating takeout, because the experience is part of sitting at the restaurant, watching the chef, you know, cook the food in front of you. You know, you're getting each dish on a plate. The plate is part of the experience, right? Like, it's not just about, does this taste good? It's about all of it. It's about going, the experience you have from the minute you walk into the restaurant to the minute you leave. And that's what he's doing. So, yeah, but again, from a visual standpoint, I still think, for the biggest moment that you've led up to this, to not punch that up visually as well as you punched it up in other areas, just because you want to say that you didn't use visual effects, to me is just arrogance. You could have easily done the explosion way that you did it and still amplified that in a very creative, a very smart way to still get the scale and the size and the gravity to go, not only is the sound getting me, so is the visuals. To say you can't create CG visuals as well in Dolby or IMAX as you can practically is just a lie. It's a lie because I just spent 4 years doing it.
Yeah.
So I've actually, that to me is the pretentious part of this where I go, dude, give me a break. Just you've got it and you can just punch that up. But I know the reason why you haven't done it is because you're trying to prove a point. And that to me is the arrogance part that I get why people don't like him for this. I understand it.
Is Oppenheimer not on Max? I thought it was.
I'm assuming it's streaming somewhere. And that's the thing. If you're such a purist, then don't stream this stuff, right? But Christopher Nolan, you still got to make some money, right? You still got to pull in box office numbers and streaming numbers to make your next film. If you're such a purist, then put this in only IMAX movie theaters and then don't show it again.
Peacock?
This is my point. Like he does a lot of sanctimonious stuff that I don't think it needs to be this way. But I still really enjoy, I love this movie, so I don't want it to detract from the fact that I really probably enjoyed this movie, maybe more than you did. I really enjoyed this movie. But
yeah,
those two things
specifically. Oh, I see. So it was Universal. Yeah. I think Warner Brothers distributed all his other movies, so that's why I thought it was on Max.
Yeah,
okay.
But again, this all is the knock on Tenet, right? This is the same knock on, what I'm saying is a knock on the last couple of movies that he's made. This isn't directly to Oppenheimer. I really enjoyed Tenet. But Tenet had the same problems. The sound is messed up. Why can't I hear what people are saying? Why is it this? And it's him going, well, you're just not watching it the right way. And I'm going, at some point, that's going to fall apart on you. You can't keep using that as an excuse.
Yeah, give me settings. Give me like video game settings. Don't make me just put on closed captioning, right? Like that's the other option.
Or just put it only in IMAX theaters and then cut it off. Go, hey, guys, I'm not releasing this on streaming. I don't care about the money. This is about me making the best cinematic experience ever. I'm making an IMAX film that only shows up in the best screens in the world. If you're so sanctimonious, just do it that way. Then I go, okay, I respect that. This isn't about money anymore for him. This is totally about the experience. You've got 4 months to go. He's going to go dominate every IMAX screen for the next 3 months. Oh, I'm down with that. Then you got to respect it because you're going, this dude's not about money. This dude's about the purity of what he's doing.
You run it like a Broadway show, basically.
100%, right? Yeah. 100%. But he's not doing that. And that's the annoying part.
So you asked if I've seen it twice. I want to see it twice because I did really like it. I mean, I liked it a lot. I thought it was really well done considering the movie is like 3 hours long. It doesn't feel 3 hours long, which is great. That said, it does feel like three separate movies.
Yes, 100%. It's at least two separate movies for sure.
Yeah. And while I did like a lot of it, there was a lot of it as well where I was like, how either I didn't understand the relevance to the story and the way you edited it created that confusion just for the sake of making it, you know, confusing, or you could have just cut it out. Like there was some of those things there where I said,
I'm interested in what
you
think.
Why is this done this way?
If you can, again, and not to just have you recall things in the film, cause I just watched it.
Right.
But it's funny. Cause I would say Alice felt similar. But I felt like I was able to connect everything that he did to the overarching theme of what he was trying to accomplish with this story. I felt like it was actually edited, and this is, you know, Nolan also has editing, you know, specifically, we just talked about Dark Knight Rises. Like, I didn't have that problem with this. I thought everything fit in I didn't sit there and look at a scene and go, huh, even the scene with Florence Pugh that people bring up of, you know, him reading this ancient scripture of, you know, I am now the destroyer of worlds while she's having sex with him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't find that to be gratuitous. I took in that the fact that there was an overarching theme of sort of the hubris of theory and the repercussions of practicality. And this guy was so obsessed with the ability that he might be able to do this that he forgot about all of the practical effects of what happens when you do this. And I thought it was heavy-handed to me, but I really, that theme is the thing that I really enjoyed about this movie.
That's great.
That was all part of it to me. A lot of those scenes were just to hit you over the head with that. But again, I'm interested in what scenes you maybe think were like, well, why is this in here? This should have just been edited out.
No, I think a lot of it was just creating this mystery around things that I think there is no Nolan movie that just plays out linearly.
No.
And I think this suffers from it because he's setting up things that you're supposed to find out later,
right?
When a straightforward narrative would have probably made it feel like it made more sense, right? Like the whole thing with Robert Downey Jr. and the hearing and all this other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole time you're saying, why are we here? And then when you bring in Rami Malek as this like big crescendo to that whole thing. And I was like, that dude was on scene for 15 seconds.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand what his importance was. So yet he was brought in like some key witness because he was in the movie for like 15 seconds before.
And
like,
you know what?
And the only reason
why you remember he was in because you recognized it was Rami Malek. Put another actor in there that you don't know, you're gonna like, who's this guy? You would have totally forgot that he even existed in this film, except for you look at it and you go, huh, Rami Malek's in this movie. And then he shows up 2 hours later and then he's like a pivotal part of this. So yeah, I'm with you there. That's fair enough.
Yeah. And then the other thing is it's seemingly like a takedown of Robert Downey Jr.'s character. And I didn't really get it. Like, look, Robert
Downey. That's interesting. Yeah.
Everybody in this movie is awesome. Like, I think all the actors are great. Everybody's doing its own thing. I think everybody's doing things so well that it's almost like a weird illusion. In a way, because everybody's doing such a good job that you're always engaged in what's going on screen.
Right.
So, but when I think about a little bit, you're just like, oh, all right, I'm going to kind of take you at your word instead of actually thinking about it. But I think that also suffers because it's so long. So putting into the, trying to slot in the pieces of everything that leads up to this guy fucking over Oppenheimer, you're just like, what? Wait, when, why, huh? Just all right, cool, I guess, fine, I'm in it, because you know this guy all of a sudden did like a heel turn halfway through this movie and now we're trying to figure out why, because Oppenheimer is also kind of a dick, and then
right. and that's part of the fact
that he's saved by Rami Malek. It's like, yeah, okay, all these pieces kind of build up, I suppose.
But there's just
a lot of things. Yeah. It's just so disconnected that it's hard to put all the pieces together in the order it was framed to me. That's why I think it demands a second viewing. That's why I want to see it again, taking the information that I have about the end and then applying it to the beginning so that I could actually more or less follow the plot in a more cohesive way and be like, oh, I get it now. I think it demands that second viewing to understand it.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I also might have ADD.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you might. But look, though, I think some of this is just he's not a traditional filmmaker when it comes to story in that way. Right?
Like which I think is great as well, right?
Like I feel like most people on first watch find his movies extremely confusing. You're like, I don't know what I just watched. I loved it, but I don't know why exactly, other than, you know, there's some great visuals, there's some great audio. I loved it. I gotta watch this again. Right. Like, I think most of his films are normally better on second viewing. Like you said, except for Dark Knight Rises, which has gotten worse.
Yep.
But like most of his films, they're more successful second viewing because you're right, because you put the pieces together. But I, for whatever reason, didn't feel that. And maybe, again, I wonder how much of this goes into knowing the history of this. Like, how much does that help for you just to go, I already know the backstory of this, I already know what's going to go. If I don't have the full context of this linearly, I know what the end result of this is. I know how Oppenheimer is viewed now in history. I know how Strauss is viewed in history. I know how Albert Einstein is viewed in history. I know how, like, it's a lot of, like, who's who of scientific, you know, findings of the early 20th century. And really, like, listening to Einstein, to me, Einstein was the glue that sort of explain this to you in a very simple way, which I also, again, Christopher Nolan's a bit of a douchebag. He was trying for you. He was also trying to explain science to you because he's like, well, I've studied these scientists. Einstein was, he explained this very simply. The film to me, he explained it very simply of, you know, you're going to, you, if you achieve the greatest thing ever, you need to be prepared that people are, one, going to take advantage of it, and then they're going to vilify you for it. This is the reward you get for changing human history, for whether it's the scientific side of it or the practical morality side of it. You changed all of history with this, and you're going to be rewarded in the worst way possible. And like you said, that was the back and forth of showing that, right? They showed that at the very beginning of the discussion, and you're wondering, you're like, oh, well, Einstein hates Oppenheimer. And then you go through the movie and you find out, no, he hates Strauss, right? Like that. That's, like you said, that's the tie back where you're jumping around in time, where right. It's like he leads you on to think one thing, and then over the time, he's going to explain to you why that thinking is wrong versus just sort of telling you, hey, this is what happened, and here's why you need to think this way. He wants you to trick yourself into thinking you know the story, but you don't.
Yeah.
And that's how he does his film.
But he does it in a way that is manipulative.
Yes,
right?
It's very manipulative. Because it's 100% manipulative.
I'm not saying, you know, unveil the curtain. Like the whole point of, it was driven by Strauss's paranoia.
Yes.
Like you don't know. You're supposed to not know and not pass judgment. But Oppenheimer is presented as an asshole the whole time. And he kind of is.
He's arrogant. He's someone who works in theory, who feels that the practical way of doing things just doesn't matter. It's about the ideas, right? The beginning of the movie starts with he's sitting there in a lab and he makes a mistake. And the guy's going, you know, you're terrible at math. You're terrible at the practical application of what we're doing. But you got these grand ideas, these awesome things that can happen. What if we can split atoms? What if we can do all these things from a theoretical standpoint? But your practical is terrible. And that is a theme throughout this entire movie that, to me, that is like he hits you over the head with it over and over and over and over again. Of, hey, show up to this lab. Hey, look at this. This is practical. You're doing theory next door on a whiteboard, but we're practically doing stuff here. Hey, look, the breakthrough of you being behind is not understanding the practicality of the world around you, of how things get done. Things get done by people who sit down and do them, not people who dream about them, right? Like that was always and that was his arrogance of going, well, no, I can bridge this gap. We can create this thing. I don't want to work in this theory. I see a solution here. I see something that can be created. And I found that each of the characters had their own place in that, of why they turned on him in the end, or why they stuck with him at the end. Like, why did his wife stick with him at the end when she had more reason to turn on him than anyone? Right?
Yeah.
And why did the other guy who was trying to build the hydrogen bomb, why did he turn on him when he had a chance to stick by? Like, you know, like it was all of this. How did they want to be viewed at the end of this based on their relationship with Oppenheimer at the time? And almost all of them turned the other way, right? Like they turned the different way from the way that they kind of started for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I think it's, and fair enough. Like I'm not here to argue whether or not it's a good movie. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I think that my biggest criticisms, like I said, I think that in creating this kind of jumping around time thing, things get a little lost in the sauce, so to speak, right?
Sure. Yeah.
I also have issue with, I'm not generally prudish when it comes to these kind of, to movies itself. Like, whatever, you want to put a sex in a movie, put a sex in a movie.
Sure.
Who cares? It's weird that it's here, because this is the other thing. This movie is an awesome history lesson.
Yes,
you want to teach people about it. It captures so much interesting subject matter to, you know, like the demands of politicians to take advantage of scientists, to, you know, the political, a lot of political backstabbing and that kind of stuff. There's so much interesting stuff here.
Yes.
Where I feel like it could have benefited from a PG-13 rating just to have more mass appeal. Like, why not put this in a classroom, right? And it's an easy cut, right? But there's nothing in this movie other than like two sex scenes that actually creates an R rating. It just felt like you did it just to say you did it, and I don't think that added anything. I think that you could have done it in a different way that was like less uncomfortable, because discomfort was the point.
Yeah, and again, I really like those scenes. I'm with you, right?
Maybe you're a pervert. You're a perverted man.
How dare you? I liked those scenes just because it continued to show his relationship, not with science, but with people that he cared for. Right? Because otherwise, you remove the personal life. This movie's not called the Atomic Bomb. It's called Oppenheimer. The movie is about Oppenheimer. Yeah. And so finding a way to show, again, they said, oh, he's a womanizer. He's even the ideas of him being a communist. It was all the theory for him. Again, he didn't take in the repercussions of his actual actions. It was the idea or the theory of what if we had different social constructs? What if we had different religions, different political constructs? What if there was a world where I did marry this woman and we had children, but instead I'm going to have the theory of this other path it was all theory. And he never actually took in the consequences until they happened. And that's why that was important to see of he loved this woman. He didn't take in the consequences of his actions. It was the theory, the idea of this love of what they could be and that's what drove him on the end of that when she kills herself. That's why he's so broken up about it, because his wife is grabbing her and going, you don't get a chance for us to pity you when you made this decision for us. So get up and get back to work. And it was the practical repercussions that he just didn't get. And it's throughout his entire life. It's not just about the bomb. It's about his relationships. It's about his relationship with his brother. It's about how those things that he didn't take into his relationship with social constructs and ideas and unionizing at the school. He was a big theorizer. And all that fell apart on him. And it cost him his, you know, his legacy, so to speak. His legacy, sure, he's the father of the atomic bomb. But as Gary Oldman tells you, when he's in Truman's office, they'll never remember you for this. They're going to remember that I dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They're not going to remember you in history. And that tormented him, really. And that's why at the end he kind of throws it all away. So I found all of those themes so interesting to me, which is why I think this movie's got a great chance to win the Academy Award, because it really dives into that stuff in an interesting way. But I think you're right. I think it suffers because it jumps around a bit, because it's not straightforward, because there are some of those scenes that do distract. But I guess I was able to suck the deeper meaning out of that stuff. But I'm with you. You shouldn't have to do that. But I found it an interesting experiment to be able to do that.
Yeah. So I don't mind the themes. I don't mind what they're doing.
Right.
It's specifically there's two gratuitous scenes where I'm like, did we need it?
Yeah.
Do we need it?
I'm with you. I don't think we need it. You can tell relationships in different ways, right? You can do that.
And the other thing,
as a counter,
so the first point, I think the one in the bed where he says, you know,
he's reading the Sanskrit, like destroy our world. Yeah. You know,
that part is a bit much. It's odd, but it's uncomfortable, and maybe that's the point.
That was peak arrogant scientist to me.
She's
telling him, while we're doing this act, read this ancient text that you told me you were studying. And the ancient text is, I am the destroyer of worlds, because he saw himself as this scientist that could possibly do this. To me, I was like, that is peak. This guy's an asshole.
But she's making him read that line. Does she know she's making him read that line?
No.
Is that just happening? Or is he lying?
He picked the line out. That, to me, that's what it is that he is, again, that's how I saw it, right? I didn't see it of like, oh, this is a random page. I just see it as him going like, that's the page he had open. And she basically grabs the page and goes, read it to me. Why is that page open on his desk of I am the destroyer of worlds? This is how this guy sees himself. He comes home and he fellates himself to science, really.
I don't want to dwell on the point, but it's like, sure, why does it have to be while they're having sex in the bed? Why can't
it
be,
like,
what are you saying,
hubris.
This? And then if you could have done the same impact, if it was like, if he reads it and then he takes her to bed and then
it's in the act of it that shows the hubris of it, of I am God.
But she's on top of him at that point.
Right.
She's in control, not him.
Yes, she's in control. But again, he sees it as in he
is still
in control.
And that's the other thing.
That's what makes it interesting.
He's
not
in
control, you're right.
They talk about him being this big womanizer, and I don't get it. They say it, but I don't see it.
No,
because I don't see it on screen.
There's another part in the story where Emily Blunt was somebody else's wife.
Oh yeah, that I got.
Right?
Look, but
like,
it was
like
mostly
he was coveting things that were not his, which I would argue back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, that makes you a womanizer. You didn't just find a woman and settle down.
Sure,
you're
but
playing
it seemed
the field.
Like
you're in this academia that's sort of in these social circles that are supposed to be, you know, again, you got to put 1930s, 40s sensibilities to this. things that we see as normal of you going out to a party or a group of people at a frat house. That was totally for a professor to do that for these secret organizations and young people. That's total womanizer fraternizing with students and people. Like, it, that's what I saw it as. Like, it's just 40s sensibilities.
So fair enough. But all of these situations, they come to him. There's not any situation where he goes to them. He might return to them, but it's always initiated. It's always like started with them kind of creating this bond with him because he doesn't seem interested in anything.
He's only interested in science, but I would argue science also came to him, right? He was having these dreams. He didn't go see. He sought this out after it appeared to him. Again, Oppenheimer's an empty shell. He sees things and then dreams of them, theorizes them, and then tries to obtain them. It's like a dog with it's like dog chasing a car. You chase the car, you grab the bumper. What do you do with it?
Yeah, but it's more like the car. But yeah. In this case, for the women, it's like the car is backed up to the dog.
It's true.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying is going on here. You're not giving me an example of him like actively.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know,
yeah,
creating
he's not
these
like
because they
right,
say
he's not
even
at a bar
after
talking to somebody, right? He's not like right. They didn't over.
Yeah,
the
he
top
just doesn't seem
would.
To care.
Yeah.
He just seems to be, to your point, you know, jumping on opportunities.
Yes.
Instead of actively creating them in that case. So fine. The more egregious point is less so although the more egregious scene is when he's in that room being interrogated and Emily Blunt sees him, like imagines him with
yes.
Florence Pugh.
Yeah, yeah. I
that
agree.
Doesn't
That's
make sense.
Gratuitous. I'm with
that
you. I'm
doesn't
with
make
you.
Sense because it's not from his
scene.
Perspective.
Yeah, I forgot about
it's
that.
It's not from his perspective. And it's crazy because everything else in the movie is from his perspective.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Occasionally you get in the other room, but
because
yeah,
that's again, that's the perfect example of talking about, you know, words and sound there were way more influential in seeing her reaction of going, oh, he does not realize his back is turned to her. Right. And he is telling them this as if she's not even there. And very matter of factly of this affair that he's had. And he doesn't realize the pain that he's caused to her. That alone was enough. Showing Florence Pugh looking at her did nothing. So I'm with you on that. It wasn't necessary, right? Like the visions of somebody else having visions. The whole movie was about Oppenheimer having these visions about you know, the things that he's done. And for Emily Blunt to tap into this didn't really make sense. So I'm with you there. I forgot
about that part was a bit too much. But yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like those, you remove those two sequences and all of a sudden you have like a more like broadly accessible movie that is basically the exact same movie, but that's it. I mean, those are the most like minor nitpicks. It's the timing. But again, like I think we've talked about this before. I like a talkie, right? Same reason I like Holdovers. I haven't seen a lot of movies this year, to be honest, but the Holdovers I think is the best movie I saw this year. And I'm curious, we'll get to that at the end to see like if your opinion of who's going to win changed now that you've seen this, but the way that Nolan could actively capture people talking and make it feel almost like an action movie is really cool.
Yeah, like how much of that is because of the sound that's constantly in the background of these people?
Doesn't matter. That's great. That's great.
To me, I would love to see this movie without the constant high amplitude, very well done soundtrack behind it of strings and crescendos. Everything's constantly crescendoing. It's constantly frantic. I understand the point of it, of this is supposed to show that behind all of these decisions that are being made, these theories that are being applied, is the panic of we need to end this war, right? If we don't get to this before somebody else does, not only do we lose the war, we lose science. Right. So to the scientists in the room, that's how politicians use this against them, are going, this isn't just about us winning some political war you don't care about. This is about the Germans or the Russians beating you to science. America's got to be first. We got to be the best in science as well as in this war. And so that constant crescendoing to me was just amplifying. There's a clock ticking. Right. There's something that's constantly ticking in the background, which is World War II. And that's why that's there. So yeah, I'm with you. Of he does a great job of having discussions that you could argue in any other movie are just really pretty calm. But every discussion here is amped up because behind it is World War II, and behind it is, for the audience who knows, there's a bomb dropping on Japan at some point in this film. Right, like you know, the idea of that happening. Right, we know the aftermath. So he plays on that. He plays on the fact of this is something that everyone knows happened. So yeah, like I, again, that's what I loved about it. I thought that was done very well. I thought the story of sort of how they're doing this and why they made the decisions they made and the moral conundrum that sort of creeped in, right? To me, I kind of wish that creeped in earlier, but I also don't, like, I think he's reading a lot of text of Oppenheimer, of when did he come to the realization of what he's been part of is a terrible thing. And it seems like he doesn't really realize it until he's kind of giving that speech where he's kind of playing to the crowd, right? Because they dropped the bomb. The scientist speech was when it explodes in the desert and they're like, we did it, right? We achieved scientific greatness. But then when the bomb actually drops, right, they don't show it. You just hear it over the radio. And it's Truman basically saying, this is what just happened to Japan. This is what we've done. Not only is this the end of the war, this is a scientific achievement that we were able to create this. And all the soldiers are outside celebrating, waving flags. But the scientists are all in that hallway, looking down the hallway, and those two guys shake hands, and it's like, okay, this is like, we did it, but now here comes the aftermath of this. And then I think they all get swept up in the patriotism of the politics of America's number one, right? Like, there's multiple scenes where there's a flag waving behind Oppenheimer to show behind this is just America, America. Mm-hmm. And that's also Christopher Nolan, who's not American, also kind of being like, how right are you, America, that you did this thing? But, you know, everyone else in the West is just as responsible as this as America is. But specifically, America wrapped this thing as an achievement in science when really it was an achievement in genocide of Japanese people. And that's where the second half of this movie then goes. So to me, I'm with you. It's like you said, it's almost three movies. To me, it's two movies. There's the dropping of the bomb, and then there's the aftermath of the bomb. And the aftermath of the bomb, I personally felt was a better movie because he cut it out with the sound stuff. There was no more of the random crescendoing. Once the bomb was dropped and it was about Strauss and the trial and trying to figure out where these two men sit in history, that to me, I was like, that's a much better movie of actually, like you said, that was the talkie to me. That was where I could actually understand what people were saying and was actually kind of going back and what did you know? Who did what to pull the strings in order for Oppenheimer to be remembered a certain way in history? And it was really because Strauss was laughed at. That's what it was. It was about you being brought down to earth and not being happy with it. And what do you do in order to prove people wrong? So. Yeah. I loved it as a film. I think this movie's got a I was like, I don't know if this has a real good chance of winning Best Picture. I don't know if it will because that stuff's always kind of a dice roll. But this movie was way better than I was expecting it to be honest. It was great.
Yeah.
And not because of the visuals.
I had a lot of criticism, but it's like, look, everybody says how great this movie is, and they're right. The movie's fantastic. Highly recommend it. Really great. But I do think it demands a second viewing, so I need to give it that. Now, I got a question for you. Who's older? And this will be the lead up to my final question. Robert Downey Jr. or Paul Giamatti?
I feel like we've done this before.
Well,
but I don't remember.
It's been a while. But
I think Robert Downey Jr. is older. He's older by like a year or something like that.
He's 2 years older.
2 years old. Okay. Yeah. I feel like we've done that one before.
Just look, insane.
I mean, Robert Downey Jr. is great in this movie. Like, the problem awesome. That I have with Robert Downey.
I mean, transformative is such a cliche word, but it really is.
Well, because unfortunately, since being Iron Man, he tends to be Iron Man in a lot of movies, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is the time where a character, even in the Sherlock Holmes movie, he's done other stuff where you're just like, well, this is just Iron Man being Sherlock Holmes. But again, this movie, I was like, okay, like he's Strauss in this movie. And yeah, he was great. I think all of the exposition at the end, all of his explanation, kind of going through why he's done what he, I thought that stuff was really well done. And again, I wasn't expecting it. You hear Robert Downey Jr. is in this movie, and you're like, okay, what are we doing? But then you watch it, and you're like, okay, he's really good. He's really good.
Oldman also showing up in this movie.
I mean, President Gary Truman Oldman does awesome though. He shows up and he's so good. He's destined to play every central figure in World War II before he dies.
Love it.
Because at some point he's going
to
show up.
Wait a minute. Be careful. I was just about to say, when does that happen?
At some point he's going to do a movie where he's Hitler. It's coming.
You need like or we just get like a Nutty Professor style where he plays all of them at once in one movie.
Or just let him be Moose, right? How many, you don't have many Italian movies or Italian themed things about World War II, right? It's always sort of it's always the Germans or the Japanese, because it's America's viewpoint lens on this, right? You don't tend to have Mussolini in movies. Let him be Mussolini.
Hang on, I'm looking something up. Looking something up.
Trying to figure out what Mussolini looks like.
No. I'm thinking he should play Hirohito, who is the emperor during, during World War II.
Yeah,
that's
that'd
it.
Be
that's going to be his magnum opus.
Yeah.
We'll go back to like filmmaking in the 40s or 50s when did John Wayne play Genghis Khan?
Yeah.
It's going to be that kind of thing. We're going to go back. We're going back. We're bringing it back. All right. So now I got to ask, now that you've seen this, does this alter your opinions on the Academy Awards?
It alters in who I think will win. Like but it's hard though. Like, I think there's going to be a lot of awards for Oppenheimer. God, I hope sound doesn't win. I really do, because it was just bad. And it might, just because it's like, well, this is one of those awards you just give to him because he put a lot of effort into it. It's like a participation trophy in a lot of, unfortunately, right? That's how it gets voted. When you can argue, the people who really care about this are going to be like, wait a minute, that was not nearly as good as this. But there's enough people who go, oh, but his Oppenheimer sound was cool, right? So like, unfortunately, I think it might get a lot of that stuff. And there's just less competition, where Best Picture, there's 10 films. Right. And there's a lot of good films in that list. Mm-hmm. So it changes my opinion of, I didn't have Oppenheimer on there at all. I think Oppenheimer is, I understand why it's the favorite. I get it. So if it wins, I'm going to be like, yeah, it's the favorite. It probably should win as a totality movie of Best Picture, and the historical significance and the way of telling a story that you could argue. We've told a lot of World War II stories, a lot of them. And this one's really good. As far as like World War II movies, this is near the top, because it's not just a war movie, right? Like, it's not a movie showing soldiers. It's not a movie showing boats or D-Day or any of that stuff, or Pearl Harbor. It's a talkie, like you said. It's people talking and there's a bomb that goes off. Mm-hmm. As far as stories go, it's probably, again, I'm trying to think, it's one of the best World War II movies ever told or ever made, in my opinion. And that's a long list of movies. It's a lot. You're talking Schindler's. You've got a lot of movies that are World War II movies. So yeah, I think it wins. That's my guess. So yeah, it has changed my opinion.
Well, I think the Holdovers wins. But I think we'll, if you compare the two, if I was voting, I'd say Holdovers, just because I can't think of anything wrong with the Holdovers. It's like a perfect movie.
And if I was voting, I would vote for Barbie, because I think Barbie is, and again, this is
because you're woke.
Because I'm woke.
You're woke and you're a pervert. You're both of those things, as we've established.
So I do think Barbie, from like totality, does something very different than what Oppenheimer does, right? Oppenheimer is telling a historical story in an interesting way. Barbie is taking a franchise that does speak to billions of people and is known by billions of people, and telling a really good story. And doing it in a way that there's some movies where you're like, okay, this is just bashing men or bashing white people. I was like, I didn't feel bashed at all. I felt like the message in the story was really good. So I hope it's Barbie, and because I want to see people be mad about it. That's always fun. People are like, why did Barbie win?
Oh, yeah, true.
Go,
that'd
woke,
be great.
Go broke. And I'm like, yeah, just let it win so we can hear people cry about it for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm up for that. That sounds good.
Yeah. Fair enough. So I hope Barbie wins, because I'm looking right now. You click on IMDb popularity, 44 out of, 6.9 out of 10. That's the IMDb rating, because it's nice. People going, this movie needs to be this, and this is Hollywood trying to tell us that men are terrible. Like, it's just, I want Barbie to win just to shut those people up.
What if Barbie wins and Ryan Gosling wins?
Ryan Gosling's got a good chance to win, although I think Robert Downey Jr. deserves it.
Totally. He's great.
He's great really in this movie. And just like Cillian Murphy's fine in this. Like, I think he's good as well as Oppenheimer. Like, again, I think Oppenheimer will win a lot of those awards. I just don't know if it'll win Best Picture.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll find out. I mean, it's going live. The Oscars are happening tonight as of the time of this recording.
Next time you hear us, if you're listening to all these, you will, you'll hear about the results of this.
You'll know the results by the time this comes up.
Yes. All right. Well, yeah, I'm glad we got to talk about it a little late, but we'll try to do more of these longer form reviews for people who watch the movies and then want to hear extra stuff about it.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, heesabroad.com. Review us, subscribe, tell your friends, share on the socials, do your thing. Why not? Tweet at us. Actually, I don't even know if that. I shouldn't have said that. Anyway, until next time.
Shuck it, duck it now.